It's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, September the 11th. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday from 10 to 12 by Island, the stockist of Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local gifts, art and clothing. You'll find them at Ocean View Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 11th of September, Sharon Brown talked to Marianne Tuazite, or Miss T, from Te Hurihi School about the Enviro Fair. She spoke to linguist Marie-France Duhamel and Andy Spence from the Waiheke Choral Society.
Okay, so I've got Mrs. T with me. So why do we always call you Mrs. T? Miss T. Lovely. Okay, so you've been involved in setting up the first Te Hurihi Enviro show. So tell us about that.
We started out, just a little group of us, talking about things we could do with children in the environment and how we could open up their experiences a little wee bit. So it started out as a little tiny idea that just grew and grew into this Enviro show, and we wanted to give children the chance to go in and actually play with things, look at things, look at some of the things happening on Waiheke with the environment. So I had a group of four teachers, and then another group of four parents, and it just grew like Topsy and has now become our first Enviro show.
Fabulous. Mm. Good. So what are some of the highlights? Have you been there this morning?
Yeah, been in this morning, and the highlights today, we have tables absolutely bursting full of produce from the Grow Group, and Upcycle is, she's in there now with all her clothes. And we've got all kinds of things happening for people to come and play with and get their hands into the dirt and look at the worms and whatever you like environmentally. I think you just might find it up there today.
Mm. And Tara, you were there yesterday, weren't you? So what was your favourite thing at the Enviro show?
Clarice's model. It had bottles made of, so they were decorated bottles, and it was words painted in black.
Wow, that sounds lovely. And so there were lots of models. The kids had a competition that they could go in for?
We had a recycled sculpture competition that fortunately coincided with the show. So we've got the hall full of different things that children have made, ranging from 3-metre tuataras to 30-centimetre cats and fish and things like that.
Mm, some people have made amazing things.
Beautiful things.
Yeah, it's lovely. And the thing that I liked was there was a stall that had lots of plants. I think it was set up by the weed.
Yeah, that's the biosecurity group.
Oh.
And Darren's taking care of that.
That was fabulous.
Wasn't it? Mm. And she's got bodies in jars for kids to look at and traps to look at and things like that.
Oh, I missed the bodies in jars. Mm. I'll have to go back.
Mm. That was a very that was a big draw card.
Right. Okay. Yeah. No, but what was really nice, what I thought was really interesting, is that they had cards which had noxious weeds on them.
Exactly.
And then they had a display with the actual noxious weed, and you could sort of look and try and identify the actual plant. I was actually really bad at doing it, but I reckon my garden's full of them, so
exactly.
It'd be good to get onto it.
It's good. And on the other side of things, we also have the Grow Group with little samples of plants for children to take away.
Oh,
and
lovely.
They've been made into little recycled plastic, they're not plastic, paper containers, and the kids can take away a little plant and go home and plant it.
Oh, that sounds fabulous. Mm. We'd like to do that, wouldn't we?
And make some paper objects out of mashed up, squashed up recycled paper. Mm. That's always fun.
And Tara, you did that yesterday. Can you tell us about making the paper mache pendants?
It was chopped up while ripped paper and glue, and I made two of them, a big love heart and a small love heart.
Wow, that sounds fabulous. Did you bring them home?
No, they're still at school to dry.
Ah, okay. And that was done by Dorte at the Waste Resource
That's
Trust.
Right.
She had a stall there. Mm. Yeah. And what else did I see? Oh, there was something from the biosphere?
Yep, there's a lovely big stand there. And a person who knows everything you need to know about biospheres. So if you want to find out about that, you can come on down and find out about biospheres.
Ah, lovely. Mm. Yep. And I saw Tom Ransom was there from Cycle Action.
Yes. And also today we've got the Squarefoot Gardener. Ken, the Squarefoot Gardener, is in. And Dee, she has an information stand, really, for you to look at things. And also the Can of Worms people are there today. And I'm trying to think of some of the others who have come in. Oh, I know, I must tell you this. Some lovely food, cookies, lots of homemade baking, and ginger beer on sale.
Yum. And just to get back to Tom and Cycle Action, he had this neat little thing that he was asking the kids, which is, how do you come to school? Mm. And how would you like to come to school? And what you could see was there were lots and lots of ticks in buses and cars, and in the how would you like to come to school, there were lots of ticks in bikes.
Interesting.
It was good. Interesting. I asked him if he was actually strong-arming the kids or if they thought there might be some sort of prize in it if they said bikes, but he assured me that no.
Well,
they hadn't.
It would be good to see kids on bikes coming to school. We had a carpool day this week, and we had a sort of a fairly average response to it. But I think next year we'll push it a bit harder and maybe get people onto big bikes and little bikes and skateboards, perhaps, and scooters, things like that.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's a shame that we couldn't do it for the whole of the week, I think, because I was finding it confusing. We had a day that was food
litter-free lunch
day. And then a day that was ride to school or carpool day, yep. Or, you know, car-free day.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought in some ways it would be quite nice if we just took the whole week and did, you know, environmental activities all week.
Absolutely. Well, we tried to do that this year. We sort of tried to change the activities a wee bit at school so that it wasn't just paint your face green or blue or something that they've done before. But our car-free day and our litter-free lunch day hopefully will take off. And, you know, it'd be a really good idea if maybe we could have a week of car-free or litter-free.
Mm, sounds lovely. Mm. Okay, so one other thing that Tara wanted to talk about was the possum trap, which I have to say, every time I heard it made me jump. Tara, tell us about that.
Well, there was a possum, not a real possum, sticked on a stick, and he needed to try get a white egg. And, well, I didn't really see anyone get the egg and bring it out.
Because every time that trap just snapped down on the possum, didn't it? It was a great display. Lots of fun.
Absolutely.
So you can go and trap your own possum and see how the trap works. I don't think a possum would have much chance in there, or
I
any
doubt
chance.
It
looked really quite
built bumpy. To do a job.
Yeah, it certainly was. Okay, well, thanks very much, Tara. That's lovely. And so tell us about, Tahurahi is also an Enviro school.
Mm-hmm.
So could you tell us a little bit about what that means?
The Enviro school group gives schools the chance to go for awards, to go through a process really of really building sustainability within the school. And it goes through different stages of the bronze award, the silver, and then the green gold, being of course the ultimate goal, which we're heading for. At the moment, Tahurahi is working towards being a silver Enviro school. And at the end of 2011, we hopefully will have sustainability practices happening in school and hopefully, again, get that award.
Mm. So what does that mean, sustainability in a school? What kinds of things does that involve?
Well, that primarily involves children thinking about what they're doing with their litter, thinking about what they're doing in their environment to protect it and to keep it going on and on in the best way possible. So it's encouraging positive action, particularly within the school grounds, and then we hope that leads out into home and goes on from there.
Hmm. So what are some examples of that?
Well, at the moment at school we have 4 worm farms happily buzzing along. We've got some beautiful veggie gardens happening and a nice orchard which has produced fruit already. We're in the process of doing our school's action plan, which is up on our foyer if people want to come in and have a look, and it tells you just some of the projects that we're wanting to do around school along the sustainability lines. For instance, outside our nice new library, we've got a muddy, grassy place that is a dead area, and one of the proceeds from our day yesterday and today, we hope to be able to turn it into a place where kids can go and sit and read and use it as an extension of the library. So it's turning an area that at the moment is just run across into an area that can be used for years and years and years.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
Nice little reading space or just a quiet zone.
So have you noticed, how many years have you been involved with the Enviro Schools project?
Probably about, directly with Te Herehi now, about 6 years.
And have you noticed a change in the children over that time?
Yeah, slowly. It's a slow process, and it's one that's where the sustainability comes in. You can't change it overnight. You have to do it slowly and really cement the practices in, and that is a long, slow process. But yeah, definite change. And this year in particular, when we took asked the children to take their rubbish home, and the change in the playground has been amazing. Also, it's a nice place now for kids to go and sit, say, in the veggie garden. They can eat some of the vegetables if they want to. We've got cooking things happening through school. We've got bug programs going on. So, yeah, it's slowly, slowly developing itself beautifully.
And it is quite lovely. Like my kids tell me, oh, come over here and you can try this parsley. And and then to see that some classrooms have swan plants outside them.
Yeah.
And that's quite lovely with the butterflies flying around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also it gives children, often children who don't play well with others in the playground or like to be on their own for a spell, they can come into the garden, they can do a bit of weeding, they can just sit in the garden if they want to. So we're hoping to develop those further too.
And at the same time you've got clubs as well, because I know my son's not into clubs, he just wants to play with his mates, but my daughter really likes, she tells me, I went to the orchard club and then I went to this club, and
that's
every day
right.
She's got a different activity at lunchtime.
Well, we've got the Enviro Kids, of course, and that's the group who make decisions around school at the kids level as to what we can improve on or beautify or clean up, whatever it happens to be. They did have part of the decision making for the show, but I'd really like it to be bigger next year for them. And the Orchard Club, of course, they go out and they lug compost around and look after the plants out there.
So what decisions were they involved in for the Enviro Show?
Well, really, it was getting the recycled sculpture competition in on time to get it into the show. So they had a big part of the recycled sculpture part of it. And then we also had the children helping set up, collecting the money, doing a bit of organisation, a bit of advertising for the show. My aim really is to have it child run eventually.
Oh, wow. That would be incredible.
Yeah, I think they'd be really capable of it, and it's a good goal.
Well, I find even my seven-year-old, if you give them a bit of responsibility, they really shine with it.
Yeah, they sure do. And they also, they pass the message on, and that's the key, that children are, they are good message senders, and they take the message home.
Yeah.
And we hear them in the supermarket saying, Mum, no, you don't buy that. You know, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah. I wish I could get my daughter to that stage.
Oh, we never know. Well, I'll keep working on it for you.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you. Okay, so that's the Enviro Show at Te Herehi, and I've just been talking to Miss T, who's come in to talk about that and has set up the Enviro Show this year, and it's the first of many, I hear.
It is. We certainly hope so. Any feedback? We'd love to hear about it. And if I can take a moment just to say thank you so much to the parents and in particular the little bunch of us who've had a great time preparing the show, and thank you very much to the people who've come along and supported it.
Great. So you've got until 4 to do that today. Lots of home-baked cooking and an opportunity to just chat and relax with people from different organisations.
Yeah, find out a few things.
Lovely. Well, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke People, Events and Issues, brought to you by Island, Art, Craft, Giftware, Clothing and Bric-a-Brac, Ocean View Road, Onirua.
Well, hi, Marie-France. How's it going?
Hello, Shireen. Very good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you've been away for a while. You haven't been doing foreign accents.
Yes, that's right. Well, I haven't had much time this year. It's been a pretty full-on year, and that will go on until December, basically. So, I had to take a year off for an accent. But I'll be back.
Right. Okay.
Hopefully in January.
Lovely. So tell us, you've been in Vanuatu. So what's that all about?
Yeah, I've been doing some linguistics field work in Vanuatu. That is... I went to a very remote place there to describe a language that's not been described at all. And there are many like that in Vanuatu. It's a well-known fact, well, in the linguistics scene anyway, that many of the native languages have no description at all. And so it's a good thing to do at this stage in my studies, yeah, which is a master's level.
Mm. So why did you pick this particular language?
Well, to start with, I wanted to work in Vanuatu for the reasons I've just said. And so I contacted people, the foreign student center in at university, and asked them to put me in touch with someone from Vanuatu. And of the two students that contacted me, one was a student in medicine there, and he was from that tiny, tiny island, and told me, yes, you know, I'll help you. My language hasn't been described. I'm very keen to have that done, and I know my community will be really keen too. And so that's how it started. But then he could never really help me here in Auckland because he had to go back to his country to help his father, who was very sick, and he was working in the hospital there. And I saw him there when I was there, yeah.
Lovely. Good. So what was it like living out in Vanuatu?
Well, I had two trips, one in March and this one that I'm just returning from. That last one was certainly much easier in terms of... climate, and it was just so much drier, and the weather is very settled. That makes everything much easier. The first one was hard. It was hard because so hot, being in a place where there is no electricity. There is also malaria there, so you have to be very careful of mosquitoes, and obviously when it's humid there are many mosquitoes. So that second trip was much easier. But that said, the first trip was full on because I had so little time. I worked like mad, which didn't help actually. I was really very tired. And I collected a lot of material that then I could work on for the 3-4 months, and that I could also address on my second trip there. So that actually worked out really well to have two trips like that, because I could I came back with a lot of questions, and I had, well, I could solve them all, which is quite amazing, really.
So have you got a track that you wanted to play
Yes,
for us?
I brought some music because Vanuatu people have especially the young people have that type of music they call string band music, which is they play all sorts of string instruments made up from whatever they find, really, and that's quite amazing. When you arrive in Port Vila, actually, you always have a string band playing in the airport for you.
Wow.
And that's really lovely. So just listen to that one. I think it's called Awasimix. I have no idea what that means. It's not in Bislama, and the band is called Saratokowia.
Right.
Long y cal.
So, what language is that they were speaking?
Oh, I think this. I didn't quite listen. Actually, I think that was Bislama. Typically, that's what it is. Though many of them also sing in their native language, which there are about 120 of them. obviously, they don't understand each other. So Bislama is the lingua franca, the language everybody speaks as a second language. Or for some of them, and especially the ones that were born in Port Vila or Luganville, which are the two main cities, really, that can be the first language and sometimes the unique language, yeah.
Mm.
That's unusual, but I think there are more and more of those, of people speaking only Bislama, because obviously they don't speak the native language in the city, yeah.
Mm. So, how does this work? You're out documenting a language that's not documented, and you speak English and French.
Yeah.
And they speak their native language.
Many of them actually speak or English or French. And funnily, in that community where I was, the place is called Etchin, and that's a tiny, tiny island that's... It's less than 1 kilometer in diameter. It's really an islet, we really should call it. And it's off a main island called Malakula. So I went there, and there are about, I don't know what the population, maybe 600 people there. And there is obviously a whole methodology that I follow to analyze the structure of sound, of words, of sentences, and it's a whole methodology that we obviously were taught. Not really taught, actually. It's something you just try yourself at when you do that sort of thing.
So what does documenting involve? You go out, you said on your first trip you collected a lot of data.
Yeah.
So what, describe collecting data.
Okay, well, what happens typically is I have one person, one participant, as we call him or her, and I ask I ask some questions. Typically, I start with some vocabulary, not any sort of vocabulary, some what we call core vocabulary, which is the one that is the least likely to have changed throughout the years. That is change in the sense that it's not the sort of vocabulary you replace by a word from another language. And that's generally things like, you know, body parts, you know, hand, throughout the year in English. I mean, that always remain. It comes from Old English, and there is a good reason why. It's not the sort of word you replace. So we... Well, linguists have about a list of about 200 of these words, and they're the ones we typically use. And from there, we can work out the sound, the phonology of the language. So what sounds are significant, which one are not.
So there's some sort of correlation between significant sounds and significant words?
No.
Not necessarily.
No.
No. Okay. No, sorry,
no.
Go on.
No, no. But we use these because you know that these ones are not being borrowed from another language.
I see.
That's
okay.
What I mean. Mm. Okay. I mean, for example, in French, I couldn't use the word chat, even though we use it, because it comes from English and we don't have the sound ch. We can say it, but it's not, you don't find any word that says ch. In French, even though we can use it in a word that's taken from English.
Okay. Right, I see.
You tell me if I get boring.
No. I find it interesting. We'll just...
Okay. So, ch is obviously not a sound that is part of French phonology, but sh is. Okay, we've got many words like that. Mm. So that's what we do to start with. So that list of words. And then we move on to little phrases like... oh, I don't know. How do you say my cat, his cat, your cat? You know, and we work out the inflections of all these. Then we move on to sentences, you know, with verbs like I hit you or things like that, you know, and it becomes more and more complex. And what we're trying to keep an eye on for is things that are unusual, pattern that we cannot explain easily. Obviously, we are looking for something that we cannot explain always. and in this language, there's always some area of complexity, you know, and you get to that quite quickly, actually. Well, if you're lucky. And in these languages, it's often to do with how you express position. It's quite complex. It's very complex how you when you talk about, for example, your some of your body parts, you're going to talk very differently from how you talk about your don't know, your ball, your spade, your something like that. That's completely different, and that's something that seems to happen a lot in Oceanic languages. So that's an area of difficulty, and that's obviously where I need to focus a lot and get a lot of data. So a lot of examples. That is, I'm going to ask all sorts of things, all sorts of how do you say this, how do you say that. So that's what we call elicitation. That is, you actually ask someone how you say this. But then I also work a lot from stories. I ask them to tell me a story. And that's because it all of a sudden becomes a bit more spontaneous. The language is really the way we talk. And I also use conversations, which is even better, really. If they can forget about me, you know, and, forget I'm here, which is good, which people tend to do, you know. I was working with men. They were all men, actually. And they were chiefs. You know, I had to deal with the council of chiefs there, and so they were mature men, really quite confident and very reliable, which was great, and not at all intimidated. So that was really good. Really, they were very good participants. Yeah.
Lovely. Well, let's have another track.
Yeah. Let me see.
Who have we got on now?
I'll use that same. That's compilation, actually, called Vanuatu String Band. And the first one is, I've heard it very often. It seems to be a very nearly traditional one. It's called Island Dress, which means that's Bislama. That means all simply island dress. And the band is called Dausake. Hang on.
There we go. So that was another of the Vanuatu bands. And so I'm talking to Marie-France, who's just been in Vanuatu studying a language over there. So Marie-France, you were just telling us about the kinds of things that you'd found, things that were special in the language that you're studying. What is the language called, by the way?
It's called Naletatsin, they call it. Nale meaning language in that language, and Tatsin being the place, which is Achin.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. So you're talking about possession. So what kinds of differences are there?
I was saying, you know, when you talk about relative kinship and also body part, it's said completely differently. Basically, that's the only time you have some inflection. That is, you have a little suffix that's glued to whatever is being possessed, and that's the only place, the only time you get that sort of inflection. Otherwise, there's no inflection at all. It's always you always have words after another word to link.
Oh, okay. So it's okay. I see. It's the only kind of way of
marking
words.
That's the only kind. And there was another example that was. You also have different types of classifiers. You use different sort of words depending on whether you talk about something that is edible or something you can drink, or you really make the difference. So with just another word, with just one word, you can say basically talking about, I don't know, a coconut. You can say, well, that's the coconut, that's mine, and I intend to drink it, or I intend to sit on it, or I intend to eat it.
Oh, okay, and that's a modifier on the word, or
yeah, just by one little word, people understand what you intend to do with that coconut. That's very functional, really. We don't have at all that sort of words or distinction in our language. Obviously, we don't. But for them, it's very, very, very distinct. Yeah, it's quite interesting.
And in terms of like nouns and verbs and adjectives, and does that work in the same way?
Well, basically, they have no adjectives. Now they use verbs. That's not unusual, actually. Adjectives are definitely not universal in languages. Adverbs and neither. They actually are just verbs that somehow they make you understand they relate to a noun, you know. So
so they tell you some sort of quality about
exactly
the noun.
Yeah, so that dress is red, that will be that dress, it is red, though it is not exactly that, you know, but it's a verb, to be red. Not red. Mm. Yeah.
So do you find it a challenge to understand a language that's organized differently from anything you've ever seen before?
Yeah, that's a challenge. That's what I like. And that's, the whole idea behind it is, of course, it's about documenting a language that's not, because it relates to its culture, and these languages are disappearing, though not all of them, really, but it's also because we need to test our theories about linguistics, you know. That's and obviously if you don't describe a large chunk of the language, what do you know? We don't know. So there's no way we can find universals about languages if we don't describe the maximum of language or very from very diverse part of the world, which we haven't done, really. In our region, many languages have never been described. In Papua New Guinea, you got about 1,000 languages. I don't know how many have been described, but that's tiny, tiny portion. In the Solomons, it's the same. In New Caledonia, there are a few more. But
so when we say, you know, like, for example, you say, I don't know, there are 1,000 languages in Papua New Guinea. Mm. Are they significantly different from each other or in Vanuatu? Or is it that they are pretty much still, like you were saying, they'd still have similar ways of understanding possession or inflecting in the same sort of way? They might have different ways of different words to do it, but the actual strategies and the organization of the languages is the same.
Well, to answer your question, we would have to describe them.
Right.
Basically, we don't know.
Right.
We don't know. That's the thing. We just don't know.
Mm.
That's why I'm doing that sort of thing. To me, as at today, that's the most urgent thing to do in linguistics. Not everybody agrees, and not everybody wants to do structural linguistics, which has the reputation for being the hardest part. But, that's what I like, I don't know, it depends where you come from and what you're good at, but to me, if I'm going to bother doing linguistics now, that's what I want to do, yeah, yeah, definitely.
Mm. Mm. So what is the urgency? What's the, why is there any urgency?
Urgency? These languages are disappearing. Many. You understand the importance of English and even French and Spanish in the world, you know, and these languages are spreading and being taught more and more for a very various reason. It's not all bad, you know. The problem is obviously, for example, in Vanuatu, we see that young people, young families moving to the cities to get work, to get more money, because education is expensive there, and once they're removed from their village or native place, they no longer speak the language. The children, when they grow up in Port Vila, they start speaking Bislama, and the parents don't necessarily go on speaking their native language, so it's basically lost, and that's what's happening a little bit everywhere. There will be many of these languages that will go on. The one I'm working on is spoken all together. They're dialects, but we consider that's one chain of language, of one same language. There are about 9,000 speakers. The dialect I was really working on, it's about 2,000. So children were speaking it, which is very good. You know, when children still speak the language and that's their first language, well, there is hope, you know, that's... But it's not to say that, you know, in 100 years' time it's gone. It could be. We don't know. Mm. So that's why I see there is urgency. And there is, for me, well, you know, I think that for linguistics we really need to know what... We need to test our theories. You know, there are all sorts of things. It's all very well to say, well, that doesn't work. But then you need to prove it or to prove that it works or you know, it's that's really, for me, that's the bottom line. But for ethno-linguistics, that's more to do with culture. And there are all sorts of reasons. Yeah.
Right, well, let's have another track then.
Yes, so, well, it was independence. Vanuatu was celebrating its 30th anniversary, independence anniversary, from what used to be a Franco-English, Anglo-French, we'll say, condominium. So it was a big celebration in late July. And so this is called Independence Song by a band called Chipajiroa. There we go.
Here we go. great. So it always seems quite happy and upbeat.
It is. Well, I hear that it's been once again voted the happiest people in the world.
Oh, really? Vanuatu people?
Yeah, so I heard. I mean, I think overall, yes, what strikes you is people are really smiley and happy. And but, well, of course, they have their problems, especially when they live in Port Vila, where they live basically in slums for many of them. There's a few problems, definitely. But overall, yeah, people are very happy. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, they
is
really
there a big problem with kava?
Problem? No. Well, there is some addiction problem, I can imagine, and people say it makes you lazy. To what I've seen, you know, the other thing it makes you is not violent as well. You know, I mean, I would rather have young men taking kava at night than getting completely drunk and becoming violent with alcohol. You know, that's really what I've seen on the island. That was really the way it was working. You know, at sunset, they would start preparing kava, which is a root, you know, that you grate and then you filter it, you add water, etc. Mostly on the island, that was men drinking it in what they call a nakamal, which is the place where they drink kava, which is a separate building. Then you take one or two or three shells. That's a shell full of liquid, and that makes you quite calm. And then you have, you have a very quiet conversation. And I think that's great. You know, I hear there are problems of addiction where obviously people are going to go every night and then they're good at nothing. Say women. And I don't know. I don't really know. They're not really complaining that much about it, though. Mm.
What was the situation for you being a woman in an environment where people are living quite traditionally and where you're primarily dealing with men rather than women?
I guess I had a special status. First, when I was there, of course, I was from the University of Auckland and people knew that. They found it amazing I could speak both French and English because I could relate to them that way. My Bislama was quite poor, but I could understand quite well, and I was starting to speak it, and at the end I could also speak a bit of the language, native language, so that was quite cool. Coming back to your question, I had that status of being from a foreign university, and I also was working actually for the Vanuatu Cultural Center when I was there, which is that status I'm given there, so I had a special visa and all that. And then the first thing I did was to deal with the Council of Chiefs of that island, and there are about 8 chiefs and the whole council. And the very first day, I went to see them and explain what I was about to do, and I got their approval. And from there, you know, you can go anywhere, you can do anything, basically, and you also are completely respected. Not that I wouldn't be, you know, I mean, as a person like that, people are quite respectful, really, very. They're also very curious, of course, of what you're doing there. Basically, you cannot walk 50 meters without someone coming to you with a big smile and asking you where you're from and what you're going to do next, and do you want to someone to come with you? But very friendly, you know. It's not what are you doing here? Not at all. Mm. It's really and what next? And are you okay? And do you want to drink something? And really, that's very welcoming.
Yeah. So what were the challenges of living out on an island in a situation with no power and electricity?
Well, when it's hot, yeah, it's a problem, definitely. There's also no water on tap. The challenge was to wash yourself when you're used to taking showers when it's hot, you know. There's no such thing. So, bathing in the sea in the evening and then rinsing myself with the bucket and all that, well, you know, you get the hang of it. And after all, my grandparents were doing that. So, hey, that can be done. It was a little bit worrying when I was there in March because of the mosquitoes. I just didn't want to jeopardize my health, obviously. That's a problem. But that said, since we were on a tiny island away from the mainland, there were far less mosquitoes, but there were still quite a bit. So being careful with that. The other challenge was feeling a bit lonely at times. Even though people are there and they want to include you and you are, it's also a very different culture, obviously. People are extremely poor in terms of material possession, absolutely nothing. That's sometimes a little bit hard to work out. Now, how am I going to prepare my food? You know, I have nothing, and you hesitate to ask, you know, to share their food because, oh my God. But that said, the food is the thing they have. There is plenty of food. They work their garden. They eat very well, really very, very well. So it wasn't so much a problem. But it's more the values and the tradition, you know, about, yeah, as you were saying, you know. I think they sometimes were wondering where I was fitting, you know, in the community. Was I with the older woman? Because my children were older, as they knew, but I could deal very well with young children. So I think they ended up putting me at some stage. I went in a church, and they said, "Okay, well, you're going to sit there." And I found out I was sitting with mothers, you know, mothers right. who had children. Yeah, that's where I was sitting. Yeah. So for them, I was there on that occasion. But very often, I was invited, you know, to do things with the chiefs and things like mm-hmm. that. So shifting a bit of groups.
Yeah, we're very lucky to be able to do that in other cultures, aren't we? I found that teaching English in different places, I get that status of honorary man, which seems to be so much more fun uh-huh. than yes. What the women are doing a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So did you interview a lot of women, though? Because is female language different from male language?
No, I didn't. And the thing is, it would be, yes, you're right, it would be different, but at a pragmatic level, and I'm not there yet. You mm. know, to get to that stage, you need to be already fluent in the language, and I'm not... Even able to grasp the difference at this stage. I mean, it's just a 1 year research. It's very short, and just two trips. I was lucky to have two trips, but altogether just 5 weeks, you know, it's very little. So I don't think I'll be able to go any further than just the structure of the language. But
so to properly document a language, how long would it take? I mean, obviously you're not going to be spending the rest of your life studying this little language, but in order to do it...
Well, you could, you know.
Well,
some people just dedicate themselves to one language so they know they can really be fluent in that language and they can go that far. You know that, or you can move on and do another language and just address the structure, which is another way to do it. Can go both ways. I don't know. I don't know yet what's in store for me next. I don't know.
Lovely. Okay. Well, Marie-France, thank you so much for coming. And will you leave us with one track before
yes,
we go?
It's called DS, and that's from the same band. I don't know what DS stands for. Just that, and that's Giroa.
Right. And next we've got Andy, who's coming in to talk about it happened on our way on the way to the forum, which opened Andy, when did it open? Yesterday. Oh, he can't hear me. I think it opened yesterday, but anyway, he's coming to talk about that. Thursday. Okay, lovely. Good. Well, you're on next.
So okay, I'll leave you with that track. Thank you very much, Erin, for having me.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye-bye. Of work. Plenty of work in Vanuatu, so if you're interested, go there.
To teach English. Oh, I think I'm a bit beyond
oh,
that.
Oh, no, not teaching English. No. Don't need that.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cheers. Thanks for that. Oh, Great. Well, that was music from Vanuatu, brought to us by Marie France. Okay, well, I've got Andy, who's...
Good morning.
Good morning. So tell us all about the forum. What's all that about?
Some people remember it from the past with Frankie Howard. You know, Frankie Howard immortalized the forum with Up Pompeii. That was a sort of a, in the genre of, a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. But we're doing the original Broadway version, and that was, it had a long showing on Broadway back in the 60s and 70s. So this is a forum revival. And Richard Melville, who's the conductor of the choir, he's always wanted to do this show. So we thought, well, let's give it a go.
Mm. So why has it taken so long then? Because the Choral Society have been going for quite a while. And why is it a particularly difficult show to put on?
Yeah, well, because it's a comedy. It's surprising. Comedy is far more difficult to do than straight drama. You've got to get the nuance of the timing, and you've really got to get familiar with the thing before you can start comedy with it. And we started with quite a fresh cast this time. There's a bunch of people who haven't been on stage very much before, and along with those who really have. And we've had a little bit of ups and downs with people not being quite as able to commit themselves. So we've limped on, really, taken 6 months to get this together, but that's wow. meant that we've really got it together now. I think it's one of the best shows we've done.
Wow. Oh, okay.
And, of course, I play the main role, so...
Oh, well.
Yes, that's part of the show. Sudlus the slave in the show has the main role, and his whole function in the show is to get his freedom. So it's sort of a bit of a look-alike of Waiheke at the moment, you know, the slave getting its freedom. So I'm playing on that a little bit.
Mm. So how do you... So playing on that... Oh, that's interesting. So can you change some of the dialogue or make it relevant to something
situation.
Local? Or
is it just we haven't played around with the dialogue too much. We've kept it fairly straight, and Richard's quite tough on that. He says, no, you stick to the lines that are in the show.
Mm.
It's actually very clever words.
Right.
Stephen Sondheim, he wrote the words and the music. And Michael Melville, he's done a great job of taking the music and actually transcribing it into an orchestral sound. So we've got a almost like a full orchestra playing to the show. And singing to a full orchestra is something I've never done before. But it's a great joy to do that.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, so it's been a bit of a challenge for you as well, because you've been doing the choral in the Choral Society for quite a long time.
Yeah, I can't remember how long now. It must be 12 or 13 years I've been with the Choral Society.
Ah, so that's great to have a new challenge
deal with. I've always wanted to sing to an orchestra because, you know, that's what you get to do in opera. You know, you get to really challenge yourself to be out there with it.
Mm.
And that's a real joy. I've got a couple of really good songs to sing in the show and quite difficult songs. One's called Free, and the other one's... in the Tiber there sits a boat, gently dipping its bow. And that's a little cute song that goes with the two lovers in the show. And they're sailing off to a far distant horizon, and I'm sort of seducing them into thinking that's what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. So what's the basic plot?
The basic plot...
give us a taste of that, telling us the whole thing.
Okay. Well, we've got a little village in Rome with three houses. And in these three houses lives an old man called Aronius. And the house across the street is the house of the prostitutes. And in the middle is the house of Senex. And with Senex lives his son, Hero. And Hero has fallen in love with one of the courtesans in the house of Lycus. And he's really in love with this girl, but he hasn't got the money to buy her. He doesn't know how to. And Sudalus thinks, this is my chance to get my freedom. If I can get Hero this girl, then I can get my freedom. So the rest of the show is really about how Sudalus wheedles and wheels and deals to engineer to get his freedom by arranging for Hero to get the girl. And in the end, of course, you'll have to come and see the show to find out what happens.
Mm, okay, well, that sounds fab. So when are the shows?
They started on Thursday, so we've had Thursday night, Friday night, and today we've got two shows. So you can, if you come along in 2.5 hours, you can see the show.
Oh, I might just do that.
Yeah, good.
Mm.
And then again at 8 o'clock tonight, and then we've got a matinee on Sunday at 2 o'clock. And then next weekend, we've got Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Saturday. So four shows again next weekend.
Is there a matinee next week as well?
On the Saturday.
Right. Okay. So is that really tiring? It sounds like an incredibly... Because it's quite a long show, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the first half is about an hour and 15 minutes, and the second half is quite short, about 40 minutes. But you expect to be about 2.5 hours, you know, from before you get out again.
Mm, but it's quite, I mean, I think just for the performers and stuff, especially if you're running that many matinees and evening performances, it must be quite grueling.
I'm going to be absolutely knackered at the end of Sunday because we've got three shows basically in the next 26 hours.
And that's a lot of pressure on your voice.
Yeah.
So were you trained as a singer? Was it something that you got into because you're on Waiheke and you thought it was fun and...
I didn't do any training until I started with the Choral Society, and then I went off to Auckland and did some work with Cyril Kellaway, who's New Zealand's opera man, and I trained with him for a couple of years to sort of develop my voice and be able to project without straining the voice, and that's stood me in good stead.
Mm, lovely. And it seems like quite a tight-knit community, the Choral Society.
Yeah, well, we've been together for a long time. I mean, there's some real old favourites there.
Mm.
Philip, unfortunately, isn't in this show because
yes,
everybody knows Philip.
What's happened? Is he not interested so much at the moment? Or?
He's doing his psychotherapy training.
Ah, okay.
He's doing his psychosynthesis training. And, of course, he's so busy with that he really didn't want to commit himself to the Choral Society at the same time.
Right.
So I can understand that.
Mm. So when do you guys, how are you organised? When do you meet or, you know, if people wanted to get involved in the show?
We're doing Mozart at the moment, two masses, and we're putting those on end of October. I forget the dates, I should have brought it with me, but you'll see the adverts in the paper, no doubt. And if you want to be involved, then Tuesday evenings we meet at Whittaker's at 7:30. And that's the way to get involved. And but also the shows, we sort of take people from the community into the shows, anybody who's really interested in the particular show that we're doing. And this show produced a whole different bunch of people. We have a new talent, which is Lucy McCartney. She's doing the role of Philia, who's the young virgin in the play. And she does the most beautiful job of being a totally vacuous blonde, which is so unlike her character, but she does it beautifully.
Oh,
and she and Hero, Michael Melville, you know, working their romance together on stage, and that's charming to see.
And you've got some young kids in it. I know Seth is in it.
Seth's in it, yeah. Well, Seth and Lucy are pretty much the same age. They're in the same year at school.
Oh, okay.
So they're good friends. And Seth's doing his usual wonderful job on stage. He's the hysterical hysterium, who's the sort of sidekick for Soudless, the other slave in the House of Senex.
Mm.
So Soudless and Hysterium have a few elbows in the ribs type interactions.
So is it suitable for children as well?
Yeah, the kids are having a great time. They're laughing. I mean, it's sort of bawdy humour. In the 60s, probably people would have thought it was inappropriate for children, but these days they'd see the same kind of thing on Watch with Mother, I think.
Mm-mm.
You know.
Okay. Oh, well, listen, it sounds fabulous. So I'm looking forward to coming and having a look.
Well, I've had some great reports from people who've come to see it. They've said I was still laughing when I got home, and you know, people really enjoyed it.
Oh, great. And how much are the tickets?
25 adults, 20 for concession, and 15 for children.
Okay, and where do we get them?
Best way is to ring 1,000. 372-1000. That's an easy number, isn't it?
Mm.
And Marion Knight, she's organising the booking. So other than that, at the moment, there's still some seats. So just turn up today if you want to come along. You know, don't feel like just because you haven't booked, you can't come.
Okay, lovely.
Maybe next weekend we'll be hopefully fully booked after the good reviews of this last couple of days.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's certainly the way with Waiheke, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rumour spreads.
Oh, everybody and, sort of waits to see what people are doing before they come along.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks so much for coming in. That was Alan Knight talking to us about...
Andy Spence.
Sorry.
It's all right. Well, I was supposed to be...
I didn't mean that. Of course I didn't.
It's because
you just mentioned Marion Knight, and it's just stayed in my head. Sorry about that.
And I was supposed to be here with Seth and Lucy today to do this interview, and they haven't turned up. Well, wherever you are...
You should have turned up.
You should have turned
and
up.
I'm trying to write something on an egg box that my daughter's trying to whisper in my ear, so I'm a bit distracted. So thanks so much, Andy.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me along. It's been fun.
You have a lovely day.
All right, I will
do.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Now. Bye.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website, www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Onirola.